Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Killer Jeans Stripped Down, where we talk about everything true crime and then some.
You'll hear about the cases that are close to us and go behind the scenes of true crime reporting.
We'll also talk about case updates and breaking news, as well as speak with some of our friends and colleagues in the world of true crime.
Now, we're going to be sharing things we've never been able to talk about because certainly inappropriate to post online, but this is the platform that we can finally share it, what really happens when gathering true crime stories.
So, let's get to it. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Killer Jeans Stripped Down. We are super excited to have our guest today. It's my very good friend, Phil Waters, who is a retired detective with the Houston Police Department. And he had a show on Investigation Discovery called The Interrogator, because the man is legendary when it comes to interrogations and getting confessions out of suspects. Phil, welcome to Killer Jeans Stripped Down.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Phil, you have some amazing statistics. Over 400 plus homicides. You have 96% clearance rate. 90% of those were confessions. What makes you so good?
I would say I worked very hard at my craft. I always had the attitude and still have the attitude that I wanted to learn something new every day. Never considered myself to be the expert or the know-it-all. Always wanted to learn new techniques. I watch some of these shows on television now on Oxygen Channel and so forth that are all about the interview. And I watch those from a critical standpoint, but I want to see if there's something there that I can take away and use in what I do in the interview process. So I'm a great poacher. I mean, I'll take those ideas, those good ideas, and then I'll see some things that perhaps that I would never do or that I have done and made that mistake in the interview room. And I go back and I'll critique my own interviews to see if I made those same kind of mistakes and learn from those and to get better at what I'm doing.
What do you think is the number one goal or approach when you walk into that room? You know, how... Is there a certain method for a confession, or is it really the relationship that you have to nurture in that room with the criminal?
Well, kind of a combination of those things you just mentioned. The first thing in walking into a room is you need to be confident that you're going to get what you need from this person that you're interviewing. And that doesn't make any difference what the topic is, but in my case, it was always the homicide investigation. And so I never walk into a room, and I'm not talking about being cocky. I'm talking about being confident that you're going to get the information that you need. And it's always a journey for the truth. So it's not, and I would tell folks that, and in the instruction that I do in teaching interview, it's always about the relationship. Because that's what life's about, and it doesn't change in the interview room. It's just a different type of relationship. So you have to start to build from a position of getting this person to trust you. And because, and of course, in my case, it was trying to get somebody to tell me the truth about the most horrific act you can commit on another human being, the taking of a life.
Phil, have you ever been nervous during an interview or scared of the person that you're sitting across from?
No. I'll tell you from my own standpoint, I'm a Christ follower, and I pray before I walk into the interview room. I think early on in my career, especially as a homicide detective for 23 years, I always had it was very vivid in front of me that I was employed by the Houston Police Department, but I worked for God. So when I walk into that room, I know that I'm walking into darkness, and I know that I'm bringing the light into that darkness. So in terms of fear or being scared or nervous, I would tell you no. Now, in the course of an interview, especially when I would get to the demonstration part of it, I would sometimes use myself as the target. I would say, you know, show me what you did to this person. There's one occasion that stood out in my mind where I became a little concerned. I wasn't really scared or nervous, but when I realized what I had given this guy an opportunity to do, and it was involving a stabbing. This guy had stabbed his girlfriend to death and was hitting her so hard with the knife that he stabbed her in the neck and then broke the blade off in her neck. So it was a pretty violent application of a edged weapon. And we had just gotten in some prop knives into the division to use for these scenarios, for these demonstrations. So I went and grabbed one of these prop knives and gave it to this guy. And I said, okay, show me what you did. So he starts to show me what he was doing. And in the course of it, when I'm kind of crouched in a chair and he is standing over me and he is jabbing the knife toward me, I suddenly had this epiphany that the knife that I gave him, while it was a prop knife and it was made out of plastic, it was made out of a very sharp, a very hard plastic, and the point of the knife was acute enough that if he'd have wanted to plunge that thing into my throat, he could have done it. So that point in time, I just made a note to self that I'm not going to use that prop knife again in a demonstration. Not on myself, of course. So that was the only time that I can think of that I was really concerned about that part of the interview.
Wow, and rightly so. I can visualize that moment for you.
Well, I've got it on video. It's a pretty... it's kind of funny. I've got it on video and I'm kind of watching myself, but it was that was a mind opening.
Now, when it comes to these confessions that you're getting, which, you know, actually I, as a local reporter in Las Vegas, I remember I was the first one to visit a woman after she was taken into custody, and I ended up talking to her just as a friend, and she blurted out within our conversation about 30 minutes or so, I had no choice. It was self-defense. And that is ultimately what they ended up using in court, tried to get me to testify, but I did not, but I did use that part in my story and they played the story in the courtroom. Right. Is there a certain duration that it takes for someone to give up the truth? And do you think it's forced? Do you think it's accidental that they just, you know, admit it? What's the rate for you?
No, I don't think anything's accidental that happens in that room. Now, and of course, in part of the process, you're in there, you're reading body language, you're listening to what they're saying, you listen to how they're saying it, and there are admissions that they may make, or they may make misstatements that you can kind of catalog, and then you come back around and you start hitting them with what they just said. And so you have to understand that most folks in that room are trying to spin a story that makes sense to the detective that's interviewing them. And I don't know that I would use the word accidental, but their tendency is to sometimes say something that they don't really realize that they have said that is keying the detective on what the next set of questions is going to be. So I don't know that you might call them a Freudian slip. They may say something that the minute it comes out of their mouth, they realize that they should not have said that. I don't know that I would categorize it accidental. I think I would make it more unintentional on their part. Maybe that's just a semantics thing, but when people, and especially in your situation where somebody just blurts it out all of a sudden, that's not accidental. That's just something that their anxiety level got to the point where they had to say something or they were going to burst. And that's kind of the whole point of the interview process, because some people, you can get a confession, you can get those admissions from them in 45 minutes. I've been in the interview room as long as 4 to 6 hours and finally obtained what I was seeking, which was the truth. And so it varies. It varies with the person that you're speaking with. And we have different gauges that we use to see if we can get an insight into how long we're going to be in that interview room, of course.
Phil, I've always thought, you know, for what you do, you know, you're an investigator, you're a statement analysis expert, you're a body language expert, you're a psychologist. You know, when you're in the room, though, how do you separate, you know, I don't even know if separate's the right word, but by going by the book in your training versus what your gut is telling you to do and to drive the conversation, which one is it for you?
Well, it's a combination of those things. I mean, I have facts in front of me. You know, one thing I've always said is that people can state facts without telling the truth. I mean, the media does it all the time. Politicians do it all the time. So there is a distinction. And when you're listening to what's being said, and I know you keep calling me an expert there, Kelly, but I'm not an expert. I'm very experienced in these types of things, but the interview, the art of the interview is kind of a pseudoscience, so there's really no expert in it. I have trained myself, and my experience level is where I'm more experienced in it, so I think that's what brings about the success. All I can tell you is that the philosophy with which I conduct an interview, look, techniques are techniques. You know, the approach, body language is body language. Eye movement is eye movement. And so the types of questions you ask, they're either open-ended, they're closed-ended, they're mirror questions. So you, those techniques are out there. It's just a question, I think, that myself, my old partner, we developed a delivery of those commonly used techniques in a fashion that brought us a great deal of success, because we are genuine to the person we're talking to. We're not in there trying to put together some formula that we think is going to get this person to all of a sudden, you know, one and one suddenly equals two and boom, they're confessing. So it's a combination of things in the room. And of course, the more you do, the more experience you gain and the more mistakes you make, then you learn from those, and you get to, at least in my case, I just formed a, because my way of interviewing in terms of my approaches or my personality is much different from my old partner's. We had a different way of doing the same thing, and we were both equally successful in what we did. We just took a different approach.
So, for example, just to give people tips to get to the truth from someone, doesn't have to be a killer, just can be anyone in any scenario, right? As specific as you could get. For example, what I like to do with personally and professionally is I will take something and I will say it as if it's a fact, and I will deliver it with conviction as if it's a fact. And I really don't know. That's my method. So the person thinks, well, okay, she knows, you know, so I should bend a little bit. What are your tips?
Well, that, Kelly, in the business, we would call that a bluff, because you're making a statement, and you believe it to be at least factual, and the other person, and your expectation is that they're going to respond in the same way, right? I mean, is that what I'm kind of hearing?
Right. That they're going to say...
they're going to affirm it.
Exactly. Like, okay, she knows, so I might as well just, you know, give up the rest. Right. Because I say it as if I already know I've got some information that you're not aware of.
Right. So the problem, the only problem with that is that I never did a bluff unless I knew the answer to the question or the statement that I was making. And because I have seen folks that have run the bluff, didn't know the answer. And so the minute that that person you're talking to, that they were talking to, realized that they were bluffing, then they called them on. And once that's done, then your relationship has ended. They're not going to trust you any longer. I'll give you a quick example. So my old partner, he went in and was talking to this guy. He'd been brought in by another detective to go in and conduct this interview. So he goes in there with this interview, and he's talking to this guy, and it's kind of a homeless guy, and he's murdered somebody, and this and that, and this and that. So my partner goes in and he starts telling this guy that there's a new technique now that the last images seen in the eye can be captured. There's a new piece of medical instrumentation that can actually capture the last image. So he asks this guy, so what's the last image that that this victim saw? What do you think the last image that he saw? I'm pointing this guy to tell him that it was him, of course, right? Well, the guy started laughing, and he said, you know, before I got into this situation, before I became a crackhead, I had a doctorate in computer science. And he knew that the science didn't exist, that this was a total bluff. And so from then on, it was, you know, the interview was over. Now, that's a little bit different than what you're talking about, where you're just making a statement of fact and you don't really know the answer to the question, but the same result, the result's the same. So you have to be very careful in there about offering something to them that they know is not true, because that'll destroy the relationship of trust.
What would be, is there a 1-2-3 ABC approach that anyone across the board could use to try and get the truth from someone?
Well, I think there's some steps. I mean, you've got to be educated on the different techniques. That'd be the first thing, is you've got to educate yourself on how to conduct an interview. Either go to a class. I mean, there's all sorts of classes out there, right? The Reed techniques. I mean, there are all sorts of classes out there, and I've been to 3 or 4 of those classes. And what we did, we just combined what we liked and we threw out what we didn't like and kind of came up with our own. But so I think you've got to train yourself in the art of the interview specifically. And I call it an art. It's not work. It's an art. Then you have to be patient. And the first thing is, and I would say patience kind of goes with what I'm going to say next, but you have to listen. You have to develop the ability to listen. You know, God gave us 2 ears and 1 mouth. That's why we're supposed to hear twice as much as we say. And I've seen new detectives, new into the interview process, that think that they have to be constantly doing something or saying something. So many times, if they would just stop and listen to what's being said, then that gives them the next set of questions. So I think as far as a 1-2-3, I think first thing is you've got to get to the training, and then you've got to develop patience and the ability to listen in that room and be truthful, because remember, you're establishing a relationship with someone. And it's you've got to be able to develop that trust. So that would be a very condensed 1, 2, 3. But I think those three things would be, and then maybe add that fourth one on the end, but would be the formula that I would use to, and that's kind of what I do and I teach. You know, here are the steps, and you've got to learn how to apply them.
Phil, I've always been fascinated with suspects, persons of interest that have made false confessions.
Kelly, you know better not never to use that term.
Right? I know, right? What do you always say, Phil? Go ahead, tell us your mantra.
Well, Persons of Interest was a television show on CBS. And if I'm interested in you, you're a suspect. So I don't ever use the term Persons of Interest. And I don't know who started that, but every law enforcement agency in the country uses it. And it's just, I cringe every time I hear it. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, I love it. And ever since you've told me that, I've always been cautious to catch myself on that. But I've always interested in false confessions. You know, a lot of things have been coming out, and there's a lot of debate on it, especially when it comes to minors. But in your experience, what has been your interaction with people that have falsely confessed?
Well, I this goes to experience. It goes to listening. And there are, in my experience, I think I've only had a couple that I can think of, and I really can't think of the specific ones off the top of my head. But it was clear that they're just saying things that don't add up. Because I know the facts. I know what has happened. And it's just not, it just doesn't comport with what I know to be the truth at that point, right? Why people do that, I have no idea. I do know that I've watched a lot of these shows where false confessions were taken from people in the sense that I have never taken a false confession in my entire career. There's no one that I spoke with that gave me false confessions. Everyone that I've spoken to that provided a confession did it. So when we look at these false confessions that are on some of these shows, and I watch the officers and the detectives that are conducting the interviews, and I understand it's Monday morning quarterbacking. However, looking at the way they conducted the interviews themselves, I completely understand why that person felt like they needed to falsely confess. Because I think 99% of those people will tell you that all they wanted to do was get out of that room. And they were in there for a long time. They finally got beaten down where they realized that the only way I'm going to get out of here is to tell this detective what they want to hear from me. And that's where all these false confessions come about. And there are other, the detectives aren't doing their homework. They get so, sometimes this can be a problem. They get so tunnel visioned on this person that they're not willing to look at the possibility that they've got the wrong person there. And they kind of developed, I've seen a couple of these where these detectives just developed an obsession. I mean, it was obvious that this was not the person to me. I mean, on the outside looking in, but and I had a, you know, I'm just very wary of that because again, it's always seeking the truth. I don't want to take a false confession from somebody. I don't want somebody just to say that they did it. Just so I can put another, pelt on my belt. I mean, that's ridiculous. And, but I think some guys, they get in that room and they get kind of obsessed and they're not willing to. I mean, I've talked to people that I was certain I had the right person here, but then they said a couple of things that didn't set well with me. And I went and did some research on what they have said that didn't set well with me, and I determined, you know, I got the wrong person in here. And but that's my responsibility. That's my responsibility as a homicide detective, seeking that truth and making sure that if I've made a mistake, if I've got the wrong person in there, is going and correcting that as soon as possible.
How much does body language play a role?
Ooh, I'd say body language is, I don't know if I could give you a percentage, but I will tell you it is the, in my view, it is the greatest component in an interview process, because the body will do things at levels of anxiety and in those settings that it cannot control. So the conscious mind, the person you're speaking with, cannot control what their body is doing in reaction to the level of anxiety they're experiencing. So body language is, in my view, is maybe the, it's the most important component in that interview room.
Phil, you also mentioned the other day when we were chatting that food plays an interesting factor in how your interview is going. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. That is, we always used food as a barometer to tell us, to give us an idea of how long we may be in that room and give us an idea of what the level of anxiety is with the person that we're about to go interview. So we would take some people. We had the cab driving killings and Chad Blackshear. So it was a really cool investigation. It was great. And we get this guy, and so we're going to take him. I'm taking him. I'm going to interview him. And my partner was going to interview his girlfriend, and they were involved in these Bonnie and Clyde aggravated robberies, killing of these cab drivers. So I do my research on, and that's another thing I'll just throw in here. It's very, very important to be prepared for the interview. So you want to do as much research on the person that you're going to be talking to as you possibly can, so that you can kind of get an idea of their background. Well, with Chad, I found out that he had been in the Navy, and he had been discharged from the Navy for either bad conduct or some such disciplinary problem, something like that. And and I was in the Marines. So the minute I had him in custody, and this was going to be a custodial interview, the minute I had him in custody, the first thing that I started talking to him about was this shared military experience we had. Now, I know his wasn't necessarily successful as mine. However, it gave me a bridge to even talk to this guy about something other than what we were going to talk about, and the ride down to the interview room. So in the process of that, we decided to pull through McDonald's. I asked him if he was hungry, and he said yes. So we go through McDonald's, we get him his Big Mac and his Dr. Pepper, and we head up to the office, and we got him a happy meal, but we took him up there, and so I said, it's yours, you know, you can eat, you know, have at it. So I left the room. Well, I think he ate one French fry and drank a little Dr. Pepper, and that was it. Didn't touch anything else. So what that tells me is that he's got a lot of anxiety working right there. He can't even eat. It's at the level that he cannot eat. So that I'm getting indications here that this interview is going to be relatively short. It may be 45 minutes, maybe an hour, but I don't think we're going to see an extended interview. Now, I've had people that we've done the same thing with. We gave them the food, we put them in the room, and man, they wolf that stuff down. That's an indicator that they don't have any particular level of anxiety, and we are going to be in there. We may be in there for a prolonged period of time because they obviously don't have any particular remorse or regret or questions about what they've done.
Hey, KG listeners, Kelly and I, well, we love a glass of wine, but lately we've actually traded it in for some CBD, and we've stumbled upon a line called CBDX that has cracked the code of the calm, relaxing with a strong hit of THC.
Here's how. By using a federally legal form of THC, and take it from us, you will definitely feel it. Now, I use the vapes and I absolutely love them.
The gummies for me, which seems to be the line's strongest product, and you definitely feel it.
They use Delta 8 THC. It shows up on a drug test, so be aware. And because of its strength, don't drive or operate heavy machinery.
The most convenient part about CBDX is there is no hassle of going to a dispensary and paying those taxes. And if it's not legal where you live, then it is a no-brainer for a legal delivery straight to your house.
Now, get 20% off and a free gift by going to CBDX.com and use the code word KILLER.
That is so interesting. And anxiety, it's a fascinating thing what it does to the body. How often do you come across people that can control their emotions? And I mean, that's something that's important on every scale of living, right? Take the emotion out of it and calm your inner self so you can, you know, handle yourself in certain situations, fight or flight type of scenario. How many people have you come across that have that ability to control their emotions at that level of fear and, you know, worry?
Well, it's interesting. So controlling emotions and anxiety, to me, they may be a distinction without a difference, but it's kind of two different animals. I've talked to people in the room. It was always amazing to me that the emotion side of it, I mean, them getting upset and all that kind of stuff. Once you start talking, of course, that's a lot. I have a lot to do with that. In terms of emotions, I need to calm them down and I need to have them speak to me, not through their emotions. I want them to talk to me with a more calm spirit. So part of that relationship building is getting that emotional part calmed down. Now, the anxiety level is the thing that I'm concentrating on. You know, if we can get the emotional thing ratcheted down, whatever that emotion is, whether it's anger, whether it's fear or crying and that kind of thing, we want to get that under control. But my job is, from the beginning, is to lower their anxiety level. And again, this goes back to developing the trust. And that's the responsibility of the interviewer. And so you've got to kind of look at what is it that sets them off in the course of that conversation? If you don't, I'll just give you an example. So one of the first things that I'll ask somebody is, what do you want me to call you? Do you want me to call you by your first name? Do you want me to call you by this or that? Because some of these guys may have a street name they go by. And I just want to make sure that we're on the same page and start in the beginning of our relationship, because I don't want to be too familiar. My old partner went in and talked to a suspect in a capital murder of a police officer, and his nickname was Ghetto. Well, he walked in, and the first thing he did, he referred to him as Ghetto, and well, Ghetto looked at him and said, I don't know you well enough for you to call me that. So, boom, that's not a good way to start an interview. So you don't want to start off adversarial because you have referred to them in a manner in which that you don't have a right to call them. And so I would always make that clear. And so what I always thought was interesting was that I interviewed a capital murder suspect, and I said that same thing. I said that very statement to him when we started. I said, well, my name, you can call me Phil. And what would you like me to call you? Would you like me to call you Michael, or would you like me to call? He goes, well, they call me Mike G. And I said, okay. I said, well, is that what you want me to call you? And he goes, yeah, you can call me Mike G. Well, the minute he did that, so check that box. So we're starting this relationship off in a great way, because he felt comfortable enough with me that he wants me to call him what his friends and what his people on the street call him, Mike G. So that makes the conversation start off with a familiarity that we didn't have before we started it. So little techniques like that will move you into that relationship that you're trying to develop and trust.
Phil, I'm going to put you on the spot. You already talked about how you thought you were going to get stabbed in the neck during an interview. Is there any one case that really stands out to you, whether it be the successful confession, the atrocity of the crime they committed, you know, just one that has stuck with you all these years?
Well, there's a bunch of them, Kelly, but I will tell you that the one that stands out most to me and in regards to the interview process was a 27-year-old Muslim Iranian woman who had buried her 2-month-old baby alive.
Good Lord.
So that's the case that that's first on my list of it was the most challenging interview I ever conducted. And in terms of what was accomplished, and this sounds, I guess, odd because of the topic, but it was the most rewarding interview because of the challenges.
What would you say the biggest challenge was during that interview?
Well, we were so completely opposite of one another. I mean, completely opposite. This gal, she had been in the United States for 5 years. She was in an arranged marriage. She was living with her in-laws. And that household was run under Sharia law. She had another child, a little boy, with her husband. She had been treated for depression in Tehran, which I'm sure there's a lot of people in Tehran which would be treated with depression. But and then when she had come to the United States, she had also been treated here. And, you know, here I am. And she's Islamist. She's Muslim. Farsi is her first language, although she spoke very good English and understood English. And she's sitting in the interview room wearing a hijab. And, you know, I'm a Southern Baptist boy from Tulsa, Oklahoma. So you couldn't pick a more different set of circumstances in terms of the people that were talking. And HPD, fortunately, has great resources. So I found an Iranian Muslim patrol officer who spoke Farsi, and I wanted him in the room with me to translate. Only to translate, not to take part in the interview, but to translate so that there was no misunderstanding between us. And this was so challenging because of the differences, but I teach that how you get through to anyone is to treat everybody with dignity and respect. It doesn't make any difference, race, creed, color, orientation, background, religious background. Doesn't matter what flavor you are, you treat everybody with dignity and respect. And the way that you do that is remembering the three things we all have in common. Again, there are no boundaries. All of us, everyone on the planet, we have three things in common. The first one is we all want to be loved. We all want to be respected. And we all want to take care of those who love and respect us. We just make different decisions on how we accomplish those three things. So walking into that interview room with her, with that philosophy, is how I was able to communicate with her. And I was brought in to do the interview, by the way. It was not my case. It was came across as a kidnapping case on evening shift. The woman said that her 2-month-old baby had been kidnapped by some black guy. You know, blah, 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 and all that stuff. She'd been in the United States long enough that she was westernized, that she, you know, blame it on the black guy, right? So she claimed this. Well, they had her down at the station. Of course, they're working as a kidnapping, and I get brought in to, and I think everyone on that shift knew that this was not a kidnapping. There's something else going on here, but they bring her down. They call me in to do the interview. I go in and interview her, and this is non-custodial, which means she's not under arrest. She's not in custody. She's free to leave anytime she wants. And so we begin to talk. I've got Tony there, the police officer, and we're communicating, and things are going great. But she's continuing to stick to this story. She's not coming off of it. So about 3 hours into it, I finally made a tactical decision in the room that I was going to walk out of the room, which I normally do not do. But I felt like, you know, I'm going to just step out of the room. I noticed first thing that she's wearing a trench coat, and on this trench coat was a raincoat was mud. And I noticed her shoes were muddy. So, you know, in homicide, we call that a clue, right? So I knew that there was something else going on here. And the first thing we need to accomplish is, where's the baby? That's the first question, not what have you done? It's, where is the baby? And so we rocked along, and I just got this. My instinct was is to walk out of the room and let her and Tony discuss in Farsi whatever they're going to discuss in there. So I did. I walked out, gave them about 10 minutes. I'm watching them on the monitor. I go back in, and Tony says to me, she knows where the baby is. And I went, okay. So I sit down, and now I have to build her up so I congratulate her. I tell her how proud I am. We've gotten this far now, and we'll now the question is, will you take us to the baby? So we had this discussion for another, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. And she's still kind of, I don't know, and da-da-da, and all this other stuff. So I said, well, it worked before. I'm going to try it again. So I walked out of the room again for about 5 minutes, walked back in. Tony's response to me is, she'll take us to the baby. Again, congratulate her. Tell her how proud I am of her. And I told her what we were going to do. Tony was going to go. I was going to go. And she would take us to where the baby is. She turned to me, put her hand on my knee, and said, I want to go with you. So I can tell you that was a incredible moment in that interview for me. Because here's somebody who is so the opposite of me. But because of those three things we have in common that I remind myself of and treat her with the dignity and respect that she'd not been treated in that household, she trusted me. And her saying what she did and putting her hand on my knee at that time would have gotten her head taken off in Iran. So, and she had asked me for a couple of things. She asked, she didn't want to go back to that, to her house, and she wanted help. So those are two things that I was able to provide her that were not lures to make her confess to something that she hadn't done. So I did what I said I would do. So she took us to the body. She buried the little boy. I have to give you a moment here. He was grasping grass in both his hands, and there was mud in his lungs and his stomach. So she obviously had buried him alive. And then I got her back up to the car, told her I was, you know, I thanked her for bringing us to the baby. And the only question she asked me was, is he okay? And of course I told her no. And no emotion, showed no emotion. And now I took her, we had HPD's got a CIT unit, crisis intervention team. to police officer and a civilian counselor. They were very responsive. I had her, I had them take her, did what I said I was going to do. She wasn't going to go home, and she was going to get some help. So she was taken over to our NPR, the neurological psychological unit, and MTU rather, and was entered in there for treatment. And then I told her, I said, I'm going to have to come back tomorrow morning and pick you up. And we've got it, because now I've got to get the confession from her about what she did. And so we go back the next day. I take Tony with me. I take the same CIT officer. She comes walking out of the unit, and she's got a big smile on her face. She's still dressed in her hijab and her raincoat. And she comes up to me, and she gives me a hug. So I'm just saying that that whole case, incredible. And then I got her back to the office, and within 30 minutes, I had a full confession about what she did. Now, I knew who her attorney was. She'd already, the family had already gotten her an attorney. I knew who it was. Really good guy. He's famous for getting these violent women cases, and in Houston. And he, so I knew that what we were going to, I knew he would use an insanity defense. So I knew what I had to get her to do was I had to get her to admit that she knew that planning this death was wrong, that executing the death was wrong, and that lying about it was wrong. So within about 30 minutes, she had answered yes to all those questions. Yes, I knew it was wrong. And so this was probably the quickest confession that I'd ever taken. And it lasted about 30 minutes. In fact, it went so quickly that I had a question that I was going to ask her, and it went so fast that I forgot what the question was. In fact, I, on the video, on the tape, I said that. I said, you know, I had another question for you, but for the life of me, I can't remember what it was. But and the other challenge on this one was that we had to Mirandize her, because now it's custodial. She's been charged with capital murder, and she had to be read Miranda. Now, the challenge there is that there is no Miranda in Farsi. So my guy, Tony, he put, and that's what he told me. So he put it together. I read her Miranda in English. He read her in Farsi. She said she understood. And then she waived those rights, gave them up so that she could continue the conversation. And that's what she did. So again, from beginning to end, the most challenging interview, the most rewarding interview, and the most enlightening interview in terms of the techniques that I applied, that I trained people to use, they work.
And it also just goes to show that it doesn't matter who you're sitting across from and how horrific the act they've committed. I mean, compassion and kindness and having an open heart to that person, it just works and it matters.
Well, it does, and I'm sorry that was such a long story, but it's a very involved. It's still, and of course, I'm sure you could tell it still kind of conjures up. You know, I go right back there.
Yeah, and I just think it was handled beautifully in a tough situation, and there's multiple approaches, and that's really another learning aspect of this is there's not just one approach to get the truth. Sometimes it's kindness, sometimes it's applying pressure, you know, sometimes it's relating to this woman who obviously was going through so many things. You had to tap into her culture, her world, you know, her heart in a sense. But I mean, it's very powerful, and that's why you're so good at what you do and at people in general. I think you're just one of those people that absorbs other humans so well and makes you good at what you do.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, Phil, thank you so much for joining us on Killer Jeans Stripped Down. We have thoroughly enjoyed talking to you today, and I hope all of our listeners have learned a little something today.
Well, I'm grateful for y'all having me, and it's always a pleasure talking to you, Kelly, and good to talk to you too, Melissa.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Follow Killer Jeans on Facebook and on Instagram. It's at Killer Jeans, the podcast.
Also, be sure to like and subscribe to Killer Jeans on Podcast One, Apple, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, need some new wardrobe pieces for 2022? We've got you covered.
Check out our line of exclusive Killer Jeans branded apparel and accessories only available at shop.podcastone.com.
Because we all have killer jeans.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Van Maul, host of I Survived. If you enjoy I Survived, we are excited to announce a new launch. Starting November 15th, we'll be reposting our classic episodes from season one of I Survived. We hope to reach a whole new audience with these important stories of survival. And for those of you who have been with us since the beginning, we think these powerful episodes warrant another listen. Starting November 15th, look out for those episodes and more news from I Survived.